Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two men in the middle of the country get together and talk about politics, current events, and other fun stuff. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Kinnig.
Brandon, the big story this week, of course, is Afghanistan. The 20-year Afghan war, I believe the longest war in American history, unceremoniously kind of came to an end with pictures that were reminiscent of the 1975 lift of American personnel off the roof in Saigon. After we were told by President Biden that in no way, shape, or form would the history of that retreat or withdrawal be repeated. Just before we dive into this, because there's like 19 layers to peel back from all of this. What was just your gut visceral reaction to those photos coming out of the airport where the Afghanis had spilled over onto the runways and were in a complete panic of desperation trying to get on any type of plane to get out of that country?
Well, to me, it was horrifying because I think you saw people that were willing to risk death, people that were hanging on to the planes as they ascended and then fell to their deaths, and the desperation and just knowing that after 20 years, Afghanistan was reverting back to where it was. It's like the clock going back. And so I think, and it represents just a complete failure of policy over the last 20 years. And I think that's why it was also so tough to take in, because it was the imagery of what was happening on the ground with the realization of the magnitude of our failure. You're talking about a 20-year war, $2.4 trillion spent, thousands of American lives lost, over 66,000 Afghan lives lost, and billions spent monthly. And it's to wrap your head around that, that's something Americans don't think about. We have been spending billions in Afghanistan every month for 20 years. Billions a month, every month for 20 years. And this is how it ends.
And you use the term a return on investment on Afghanistan.
Right.
There's a couple different ways that you can look at it. One way is complete failure. We spent $2 trillion. We spent 20 years, 2,500 roughly service people lost, tens of thousands of more injured. And the result we got was the group that we kicked out is now right back, stronger than ever, and in charge.
Right.
That's one way to look at it. And I think you'd agree that that's the complete fail look. The other way is in 20 years, there's not been a significant attack, terrorist attack on the United States. And in some ways, people are like, we've all moved past 9/11.
Right.
And we've kind of pushed that to the side. And one way to look at what did we get for our $2 trillion and our 20-year investment is we got 20 years of no terrorist attack coming out of Afghanistan. We got 20 years where terror cells weren't allowed to develop in that part of the world. I heard average lifespan for Afghanis increased by 7 years over the last 20 years.
Yeah, and I don't want to say that it was all doom and gloom. So it's a very mixed, nuanced picture, right?
Their college graduates went from 30,000 to 200,000.
Right. So we brought democracy. It did take hold in all parts of the country. So let's not forget that the Taliban retained pockets of control in parts of Afghanistan. But you had a democratic system. You had women that were going to had rights. You had girls were going to school.
Huge jump.
Increase in education, literacy. So we, from that standpoint, we did improve the situation of Afghans marginally. Now that did take hold everywhere and across the country, but we did see improvements. We saw the breakup of those terror cells. Yeah. That's why Osama bin Laden was caught in Pakistan.
Yeah, 5,000 terrorists in jail.
Right, 5,000 terrorists in jail. So, you know, there was a lot to show for that. Now, the breakup of Al-Qaeda, much of that happened in 2002. And so we accomplished most of our stated mission pretty quickly after we invaded. And the succeeding years were spent trying to build democracy, build infrastructure, build a civil society in Afghanistan and have it take root when none had taken root before.
So we kind of quickly met some military objectives in Afghanistan.
We did.
And we quickly pivoted, though, to this nation-building exercise. And I think anybody that was paying attention to that or knows anything about the history of Afghanistan or just the history we have with nation-building knew that was going to be a tough road to hoe. And that
for
was biting
reasons.
Off something that we maybe couldn't bring to conclusion.
Well, and partially because Afghanistan has never been a nation state in the sense that we are a nation state, or that you know, other developed democracies are. Afghanistan's history is one of a tribal society where there have been different sectarian groups that have controlled different parts of the country, and that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. Afghanistan had the moniker for much of the 20th century of the graveyard of empires. It's where the British went in, were unsuccessful, departed. The Soviets, the same thing. You had a period from 1930 to 1970 where you started to see some advancement in terms of modernism, in terms of rights, equal rights for women. But that was through a series of monarchs or absolute dictators, and it was still very unstable. None of those governments had complete control of the country. You had political assassinations, coups that happened, dictators that were overthrown. You had civil war for much of the 40s and then into the 1950s. So it's always had a very turbulent history, and you can go back several hundred years and there hasn't been a time when Afghanistan has been a unified country or has had political stability. And we were trying to create that, even withstanding that history.
We were trying to mold clay that just wasn't there.
Right.
I think Americans like easy to understand wars. We like a clear enemy. We like clearly understanding that that enemy is not like us in these ways. They're different. They're different. They're others. They're clearly kind of evil. When we clearly understand who we're fighting, what we're fighting for, why we're fighting, and there's only one objective, the absolute victory of our military against yours, Americans, we get behind wars very, very quickly.
We do.
If those are the parameters. And I might be talking a little bit old fashioned too. I mean, that's an opinion I think that folks of my generation have. One question is, with how we described what the outcome was in Afghanistan, if that would have been the outcome from the beginning, if it would have been explained, or if somebody would have laid the groundwork that there is no traditional victory here, what we're trying to do is establish a long-term presence to accomplish these national security goals, would a framing of what Afghanistan was, do you think America would have simply paid more attention to it or cared more about it over the long haul that we were there?
I think partially, yes. I think that was part of the problem. If you go back to the Bush administration, it was the inability to frame what we were there to do after taking out the Taliban. And, you know, Tom Nichols had a quote in an article this week, which I thought resonated. You know, he said, America went to war in Afghanistan and Americans went to the mall. Yeah, I mean, it was out of place and out of mind for many of us.
We were told by the president the way that we could get the country back on track was to start spending.
Right. And so, and this was also partially due to a change in policy, right? Because it wasn't long after we invaded Afghanistan and we were successful in toppling the Taliban that attention diverted to Iraq. And, you know, the administration wanted to go into Iraq, made that case. So that diverted a lot of attention on for policymakers, but also for the American public and media, who then shifted attention. Now, that doesn't mean we stopped doing anything in Afghanistan. On the contrary, we continued to spend money and try to build up infrastructure. But our foreign policy attention had been diverted. And so that also didn't help in terms of illustrating the case, because there was no case then made to the American people. We continued to be there, but publicly, there was no argument made on why we were there and what our objectives were.
And in 2011, Obama basically did a surge into Afghanistan.
He did.
He put more troops there. But then he also set an end date. He said, we are going to be out by, I forget the date he had set, but he basically made it very clear in 2011 that we did not want to be there long term. We were looking for an exit strategy. In 2011, too, we started looking for Taliban members to negotiate with. We didn't have a lot of luck with it, but that kind of laid the groundwork for what the Trump administration did with picking that back up and negotiating this peace deal with the Taliban. So, Brandon, how do you want to attack this? You want to take this from Bush?
Oh, there's so many different angles.
You want to go from Bush forward and try to fill in to Biden and our withdrawal? Or do you want to take Biden first and work our way back?
Well, I guess it's so complicated. So I'm trying to think logically what makes the most progression.
Yeah. We've got troop withdrawals. We've got a whole big bunch of coverage, but does it make more sense to take it maybe from the beginning and walk it forward?
Probably. Yeah. I think if the timeline wise, if we start at the beginning and where we were, and so, you know, we had tens of thousands of American troops deployed in Afghanistan.
I want to start, you know, we are not Afghanistan experts.
We are not by any means.
We are heavy news consumers and readers of history. So there's like my whole Twitter feed has exploded that everybody's a foreign policy
now
expert now.
Especially people that like didn't talk about Afghanistan at all in the past year, and all of a sudden it's on everybody's mind.
I love it when like the dumbest person you went to high school with pops off on some complex foreign policy thing, and you're like, last time I saw you, you were shotgunning a Keystone Light that you had poked a hole in with your key. So I just want to set the thing. We're going to walk through this as we know it. But again, this is one of the most complex pieces of American history. There's no way any one podcast, one book is going to cover this. If you're really interested in it, this is something you're going to have to take on yourself to educate yourself on.
Agreed. So, you know, I guess if we start in the Bush administration, so after the Taliban was disbanded and scattered, we set about creating a civil society in Afghanistan.
But Taliban and Al-Qaeda are basically, those are basically part of the same organization.
They work together, yes.
Work
so
together.
Al-Qaeda, Taliban provided refuge and a safe haven for Al-Qaeda and allowed them to
grow
and
fester,
develop.
Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, Taliban and Al-Qaeda was on the run. So Al-Qaeda, in terms of using Afghanistan as a base of operation, that changed after 2002. Al-Qaeda splintered and went elsewhere. They went into Pakistan. Now, it was great that we were able to get Al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, but the picture was mixed, right? Because you had Al-Qaeda didn't just evaporate. They went elsewhere and they took other forms. You know, you have ISIS and ISIL that came out of the Al-Qaeda, which then, you know, were based in Iraq. So you had the splintering of groups that went elsewhere. But Afghanistan, as far as accomplishing that objective, we did. So the mission in Afghanistan turned to creating this strong civil society and this new government, a democratic system, and then infrastructure, roads projects, schools, hospitals, all of that. And I, you know, the idea, if you talk to foreign policy experts and neoconservatives at the time, was that we create democracy, you know, we change people's perceptions. Al-Qaeda cannot establish a stronghold in Afghanistan ever in the future because this new system won't allow it. And so it was very grandiose and very lofty and idealistic in terms of what we were hoping to do there. And all you have to go back and look at is if you go back and look at the 2002 National Security Statement that was released by the Bush administration. 2002 actually through 2004, each one talked about Afghanistan and talked about how it was going to join the coalition of democracies and become representative for the whole Middle East. I mean, it was all pie in the sky. Now, would that be great if it happened? Yeah, but how realistic was that?
Why is that our go-to? Why is that always seem to be? Is it just as simple as these people want to be like us because we're so star-spangled banner great? Is that because even hearing you say that, it just sounds so ridiculous to try to sell to the American people that the Afghanis wanted some sort of Western style democracy.
Right. And you know, I understand the tendency to project that on others or think, you know, that these should be universal ideas, freedom, individual liberty, respect for minority rights, equality, like, you know, in some ways, you know, they are universal to a degree that there are societies and people that yearn for them. But we just assume that somehow we can implant those where they haven't been nurtured or developed before and that they will take root. And we try to do so. And I've seen these comparisons come up, you know, to nation building that we've done in Japan after World War II and Germany.
Mm-hmm. Those are a little bit different.
Because
very
those
different.
Are advanced democracies that had prior history of democracy. And they had societies that were developed, that were modern. They had strong centralized forms of government. They were approved of that and consented to that. So very different.
They knew what a federalist system was.
Right.
In Afghanistan.
And there was buy-in and consensus around that. Yeah.
So we have Bush, 9/11 happens. We go in, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, they quickly scatter. We spend the next up to 2011. We spend the next decade kind of halfway nation building. Like you said, spending a billion or so dollars a month on roads, bridges, schools, things like that.
We established several bases there.
My
cousin
there.
Actually served, and he was based in Kandahar, and he was military police. So he was going on missions like working working with like local tribal leaders, you know, trying to create basically bonds with them.
Yeah.
You know, start to,
we're trying to win hearts and minds.
Win hearts and minds. Yeah.
And so we have a decade of that with little to no real progress. Obama comes in 2011, he wins election in 2011. He has an Iraqi style surge into Afghanistan, but he also sets a date for withdrawal, and he makes it very, very clear. We have no desire to continue on any long-term basis this war in Afghanistan. We are looking for an exit strategy. When the commander-in-chief says, we're done, we don't really want to be there, I have no political will to put us there. The objective is not a military one anymore. There is no winning at this point. Morally, don't we have an obligation to the men and women in our military to pull out then and there?
I mean, if we're going to broadcast that, which is what we did, that, you know, we were done. I mean, and so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to keep our military men and women there without clear objectives and telling everybody that we're going to be leaving fairly soon.
I think this is kind of the pattern that lasts all throughout Obama's administration. We have this surge. I think at one point we had like 135,000 troops there.
Right.
We accomplished some objective.
There were some objectives accomplished.
I don't really know what those were, but I'm sure we checked a box that we did something. And we withdrew our troops down to what, about 15,000 to 20,000, and we've just sat from 2011.
It was basically status quo. Yeah.
To 2020, that's just what we did.
And let's, in context, what Afghanistan looked like during that time. You had the central government based in Kabul. So if you lived in the city or in the big urban areas, you had rights. You could go to school. You could do all this. If you lived outside those areas, that was unattainable in many cases. You did that type of access to healthcare, to education wasn't available, or you lived in areas that were still controlled by the Taliban, because we forget that Afghanistan is a very tribally segmented country, and many of the mountainous rural areas we never gained, and the Afghan coalition government never gained control of. So it was just a matter of Taliban continued to control. So you had this division in society where you had pockets that were still backwards and very repressive, and then you had, you know, the core areas that were directly under our control where you did see positive change.
Yeah. And there's fighting this entire time.
Warfare never ended. We continued to fight with Taliban insurgents and the mountains
with them. So after the surge and the drawdown, this is when I think we start trying to build up the Afghan army. And what we heard was this was an army of 300,000 men trained by American forces. They had American air power, American equipment, that this was comparable in some ways to other NATO nation fighting forces. That's what the American tagline was, that they were actually capable of not only holding their own territory, but they could actually defeat the Taliban. And we jump forward now in the timeline. So we've invested all of this money. We're trying to build this military. Trump comes into office. Part of his shtick and part of what he campaigned on was ending these endless wars. And he picks up this theme that was started by Obama, that you can negotiate with the Taliban. And I believe in February of 2020 is when they signed this agreement with the Taliban.
Right.
And I remember hearing about it, but I just gave it no credence. I gave it not a second thought, because I figured it was just something at the surface level. It had no real teeth behind it. This was one of the things that he did prepping for his presidential run.
Well, it was something he campaigned on.
Symbolic.
Right. So this happened in Doha, Qatar. So this was the neutral location where this agreement was signed. And essentially, the agreement promised American withdrawal, gradual withdrawal through 2020. And at the time, I think we had something like 14,000 troops.
15,000 troops.
And so we ended up withdrawing down to about 5,000 years in, and that we would withdraw all troops by spring of 2021.
May 1st, 2021.
And in exchange, the Taliban would not during that time target Americans and our personnel. They would not attack us. So there would be, that would be a time of peace. There was also a lot other contingencies in that deal. We also agreed to a Taliban prisoner release of about 5,000 Taliban
just
prisoners.
Just walk right out.
Right. And then predicated prior to that, if we go back a little bit in the timeline, to prep that deal, like to actually get there. Back in 2018, people forget that there was a major Taliban leader who was released from prison by the Trump administration as a sign of goodwill to get us to the point of negotiation in 2020.
So Trump is capitulating to Taliban demands. I think that's pretty fair to say. By the way, the treaty that he signed with them, the treaty that effectively ended America's longest war, was 3 pages long. That's why nobody really took this seriously. Because really, it was an absolute disaster.
Yeah,
the day the Trump administration signed that deal, the Afghan government was gone.
Well, yeah, because it was signed exclusively with the Taliban.
Yes.
So they marginalized and sidelined the Afghan government. So that sends the signal immediately that, you know, this is just between us and the Taliban. And we're basically handing the country over to the Taliban. So that was sent immediately. And people, the Taliban were very strategic and very cunning, because as soon as that was signed, they began taking over provinces and going into towns and villages.
They had a plan. They started executing it immediately.
What they did, too, is they would go into these villages and towns and execute people like pilots or people that held positions like doctors and surgeons as a warning. And then the entire town would just surrender to them and say, okay, what have you. And so they did that town by town, village by village. I remember seeing stories in December of last year about the ground that had been gained by the Taliban and looking at the maps and showing the areas that they were taking. This accelerated the past couple of months in 2021. But that was all set into motion with that agreement because, you know, they knew that they could do that. And again, as long as they weren't targeting Americans, like there was nothing that would cause the administration to go back on the deal that had been struck, and nothing did.
So one question is why we gave up the airbase. We gave up the airbase because you couldn't hold it against the Taliban with 2,500 fighters.
Right.
We knew that if the Taliban attacked, they were going to take that airbase if they wanted to. That would be a devastating loss and imagery on American television that's just simply not acceptable. So I understand the situation that Biden found himself in. Also, too, people say, why didn't we just send troops back in? Instead of trying to leave last Saturday or Sunday, why didn't we just take 10,000 troops, put them back at the airport, gain control of the airport, and get our people out? I think one of the answers to that is they know the Taliban basically has told them one American soldier steps back foot outside of that airport, we're just going to start slaughtering people. Yeah. We can turn this into a bloodbath if that's what you want to do. And at this point, the Afghan government, the military, is completely dissolved. I think almost half of them just switched sides and signed a deal and gave their territory, their equipment, and their soldiers directly over to the Taliban and to the new government.
They did. You know, the ones that were, there was one elite unit, I forget what they're called, but the equivalent of like our special forces in Afghanistan. They've been trained by our CIA, and a lot of billions put into just this elite unit alone. So like in places like Kandahar, there were like about 300 of them. So they were left and they were willing to fight to the end. They set up a perimeter before, and this Kandahar was taken over several weeks ago. So this was before they the Taliban approached Kabul. And so they were ready to defend it. The problem was the military commanders at the top of the Afghan army based in Kandahar and the political leaders had already surrendered. So at that point, that 300 said, well, you know, we're outgunned and outmanned. Like, we can't do this. So at that point, they have no other choice. So you did have groups of specially trained Afghani soldiers that did want to fight, but those decisions were made at the top. And at that point, it's a death wish, right? Yeah. I mean, why would you?
And you're fighting against a group that if you lose, you're going to die. There is no surrender.
There's no surrender. They kill you.
Your family, everybody in the villages is going to die. Nobody gets to surrender. There is no valiant stand. And at the end, you fold your flag up, salute your enemy, and go home.
And what I don't understand, like in the list, you know, we talk about how we spent billions training the Afghan army. There's a lot of issues there, right? I mean, you have tribal loyalties. You have this idea that even with all this training and money, that there's still like the concept of being loyal to a nation state only goes so far. Now, what I don't understand, and I haven't dug as deeply into this to know enough, but all of these stories about how the Afghan army was underpaid or in some cases not paid at all, that some of them are starving and hungry. Sure. So I don't know enough about that to make a determination. If that is true, that would be another failure on our part, because it's crazy to me that we would spend billions a year and that would not go towards like pay or salary for the army. I mean,
David French on the Dispatch podcast Friday had a really, really good point. And he was, David French was deployed in Iraq.
Yeah.
So he's been in a war zone before. And he basically said the greatest thing that American troops bring to an army like the Afghanis is hope and belief that with the Americans here, even a small amount of them, victory is possible. And what it feels like, we trained this 300,000-ish army. How well they were trained, what shape they were in, I agree. Right. That's all still debatable. But it feels like the Americans were their command and control structure. And when they just suddenly weren't there, the whole thing
collapsed
and fell apart.
Yeah.
David French says
it was that fragile, which I think is what surprised
without
many people.
Leader, without the person who believes I can lead you to victory, an army typically won't fight. David French talked about, we saw this in Iraq, where two divisions of Iraqi soldiers lost to like 1,500 ISIS fighters in Mosul, just because, again, when an army hits that tipping point where they don't believe they can win and they lose their will to fight, it disintegrates very, very quickly. And I think the army really disintegrated a couple months ago in Afghanistan. We just were never told that, hey, this army that we're positioning as somebody not only will take the lead, but can defeat the Taliban, could defeat the Taliban. That just wasn't the case.
No. And I think the army too, probably, I mean, as they saw what was happening in these villages and these other towns and these, and at the provincial level, as you know, they started falling like dominoes, you know, it becomes like you said, a domino effect. And so it's just psychologically that will doesn't exist anymore. But where I felt the Biden administration is that the deadline for withdrawal was pushed back to August. In fact, I mean, Trump criticized Biden pretty handily back in April for not withdrawing everybody right then and there. I was under the assumption that this expanded time frame would be time for us to strategically, and it seems like none of that happened. There was no strategic withdrawal. There was no process put into place to help get out Afghan allies, people like the interpreters who assisted us, who in many cases have visas that are still just out there, never been approved. So I struggle to wonder, what did we do with this extra time, like these extra months that, you know, instead of, so if this was going to happen, why didn't we pull out then in April or May? I mean, because I thought, hey, this is a great decision. I like that Biden has pushed it back because we can do this methodically and do it correctly.
That was the assumption. And to your point, so Biden is squarely president in May 1st of 2021.
Right.
He has to know all the information that there is to know. He has to know. So you're right. Why go through this pushing this date back and then apparently do nothing to plan from that date? And the Taliban, they took that date as kind of gospel. I mean, they started as soon as that treaty was signed. Like you said, they put their plan
right away
into place.
How
they
can
were
we
ready
not,
to go.
How can we not foresee that? That's what I don't understand.
Seem to be completely flat-footed.
Because we still had, outside of our military, the 5,000 or so military that were withdrawn, there were 15,000 American civilians in different capacities that were still in Afghanistan when Kabul fell. And I think that's what's like really just mind-blowing, is that why was it their efforts to get them out gradually as well, like during the last couple of months? Like, it's like this happened, caught completely off guard, and now we're scrambling. We scrambled to secure the airport to do these flights. And then the latest I heard was, I think last night into today, the airport shut down again because Qatar is overwhelmed, because these flights are going from Kabul to Qatar and Doha, and Doha can't handle. They've been overwhelmed. And so they had stopped the flights. And so now they had to shut down the airport of Kabul again temporarily.
I just saw an official stat was they've had 38 flights, I think, leave, and they've got like 5,900 refugees out so far. Yeah. That's like their official number.
But that's what creates mass chaos, right? You wait till the last minute, you try to do it all at once instead of gradually. I mean, and that's what leads to situations like we saw on the ground.
How do you put this plan in place if you're the Biden administration without knowing how many Americans are there in Afghanistan?
And nobody seemed to know.
Nobody seems to know. What plans have you made with the Taliban? The French and the British, they're going out into the city and bringing their people in.
And we're not doing that.
We're not doing that. Did you negotiate, or are you negotiating now from a place that you're giving the Taliban the ability to show the new Taliban 2.0 on the international stage by being some sort of partner in getting the Americans out of Afghanistan?
Yeah.
If that's what they're doing, that's insane. That's ridiculous.
Right. So Congressman Seth Moulton, who served, I think, in the Marines, he served either Marines or Air Force, Democratic congressman from Massachusetts. He was on television the other day talking about this, and he said he's been trying for months to get concrete details from the Biden administration about visas for Afghan allies, for Americans that are there. And he's been met with just like no response, like nothing. And he's like, he was super frustrated because he's like, again, I've been trying for months to get their attention on this. And it seemed like nobody wanted to pay attention.
If I was the commander, it'd be real simple. If you showed enough to get through that crowd, to get into this airport, you get on a plane.
Right.
That's all I need to know.
Well, there's a CNN reporter who was able to interview several Afghan interpreters who had their papers and everything, but they're like, we still can't get through to the airport. Here's our papers from American commanders. Here's proves that, you know, and they can't get to the airport though.
I love what the governor of Utah did, who put that note out. Just bring every single refugee to Utah. We will take them all. We are a state founded by refugees.
And I like to see these people here because at the same time we have demagogues like Tucker Carlson, Laura Ingraham, and others that are fanning the flames of we're going to have this refugee, you know, exodus into the United States. It's going to be like the Syrians into Europe back in 2015.
Because I think Europe said we're out on this one. We're done. We're not taking anymore.
Well, and Europe, that's another criticism of the Biden administration, because the administration didn't consult with Europeans either on this. They were caught off guard, so they've been scrambling, getting flights in, getting their people out, as you noted, Australia, Britain, Germany. In fact, if you saw the statements from Merkel and from Macron in France, it was pretty testy. Yeah. I mean, they're not pleased with how this went down.
The White House edited some of Macron's out.
Yeah.
It got so forceful.
Because again, this is what you wouldn't expect, right? I expected with a Democratic administration, we're going to, have better relationships with the Europeans. We're going to communicate with them. We're not going to see things like this happen. This is what I would expect to see happen with the Trump administration, because frankly, they don't care at all about our European allies or communicating with them. And so I don't think it's a case of Biden administration not caring, but it does point to a competency issue, and it's frustrating.
If your brand is returning competence to government, you did damage to your brand over the past 8 or 9 days.
And it wasn't just what happened, right? It was the
your
reaction to it.
Press conference was terrible.
Right, and look how many days.
Your
it took days.
Sucked.
Biden was basically in hiding. The Stephanopoulos interview was
correct.
Terrible. The press conference after that.
If your strongest card to play is the empathy that you can express for normal, everyday Americans, you totally failed in this endeavor.
Right.
And why... I'm working under the theory, too, Biden's not running for a second term.
That seems to be more and more obvious.
Because I think what he's doing, too, is, hey, take some of these things that... I can do some of this stuff because I'm not going to try to get to be a second term president. So under some of those, if you take some of that information, that's not some facts, not in evidence, but you allow that to kind of go into the equation, maybe you can see some political calculations Biden's playing. But I think we both agree Biden completely screwed the pooch on the execution of this. And there's no way around it.
Because there's no question. And Americans want a withdrawal, and that's where we were going. And that's one thing, but it's the way that it was executed, and then it's just the response to that. And again, like you said, it points to competency there and the being completely caught off guard by what's happening, and then seeing the images and knowing that we're still scrambling to get Americans out of there, and makes us look weak as well in terms of being able to be on top of this, because that's the other part of this is, and all those foreign policy experts have said, we have no leverage now with the Taliban. We're at their mercy. So yes, we're still able to use the airport right now, but we're at their beck and call, and we're, you know, basically begging them, like, please let us do this. They don't have to. At any point, they could just, and they are very volatile and can turn on a dime and be like, oh no, we've changed our mind. We're done. That's enough. No more flights leave.
And just Biden's whole approach, how defensive he's been about
this. He's been very defensive.
How strongly he has said, you know, come on, man, this is not a mistake. This was always going to happen. How much he has contradicted himself.
Well, and some of what he said has just been flat out wrong. Wrong. When he was asked about the Afghan interpreters, well, a lot of them don't want to come here. Well, that's not actually true. Many of them have been trying for years and now are really trying, but they have no conduit to be able to get out. So
I think if Biden made a political calculation that we can just go ahead and bug out of Afghanistan because it's an unpopular war with the American people, I'm going to take shit for a week from Fox, but by the time the end of the month rolls around, we'll have 12-15, we'll evacuated a significant number of people, and if it remains relatively peaceful, I can chalk this up for a win. And because the American people have completely forgotten about this war, I don't have to think about how it looks, and I don't have to pay attention to some of the details that maybe could have made this experience better for some of the Afghan people. And that's a very cynical approach to take, but I don't see any other way to look at this.
But the problem is, I think that if he would have been able to plan out a strategic exit that was gradual, that was planned, that minimized the chaos. I mean, granted, there's always going to be some tension and chaos, but you minimize it to a degree. You would have had this be in the news cycle for a day or so and then be done. Instead, because of the chaos and turmoil, this is going to be in the news cycle for weeks at least. That's going to exacerbate the political ramifications. And now the problem is he's facing criticism from left and right. Like, I mean, it's both sides of the spectrum. There's Democrats that are very antsy and very frustrated with how this has happened as well.
I'm open to, and I do believe that Trump put into motion a set of decisions that created a very bad situation for Biden to be in. But at that does not excuse how poorly Biden executed this plan.
The outcome itself and us leaving was unavoidable, especially this year, because we were tied by that agreement. And as I tell people, because you have these Trump supporters now that are saying, oh, well, he should have just reversed Trump's agreement. I'm like, well, great. He could have done that even if he wanted us to stay. But then we go back on that. Then the Taliban go back on their part of the agreement. They start targeting American troops again. So, and we see casualties
rise. I would ask that person, so what you're saying is you're ready for an escalation of the war in Afghanistan.
Right.
Because that's what you just said.
That's exactly what was just said.
And I think when you phrase it to people, like, oh, so you're for putting boots on the ground back in Afghanistan. Well, I didn't say that. That would be the result of what almost any decision Biden made, there was going to be a bad result.
There was. Yeah, there were no good, outcomes
I
here.
I truly believe the Taliban communicated with Biden. You put more troops back here, we will turn this country into a bloodbath. And I think Biden knew the last thing he wanted was pictures of women and girls and beheadings and stuff. And I think he made some cynical choices along the way. I think he felt he had to. And I also think he knows, too, that the media eventually, they'll have their 2 weeks. Well, they'll get their pound of flesh, but they'll also recover and be right back in his pocket in time for the 2022 midterms.
Right. Well, and I think the question that remains, so looking past the messiness and the just chaos that's occurring on the ground in Afghanistan right now, if we look to the future, a Taliban-led Afghanistan, do you think at some point that we will have to go back in to take out, and maybe I'm not talking about a ground invasion, but maybe do aerial strikes to take out terror cells that pop up again? Is there going to always be that looming possibility that we see that threat materialize?
Then why do we give
Bagram? Yeah.
Why don't we just tell him, no, we're just going to permanently put 15,000 men there and keep it. It's 500 miles from Pakistan. It's 600 miles from China. That seems like it had some strategic value.
Right.
I don't think... I think what we are limited now to drone strikes, air support, covert operations, some things like that. But any type of large scale military operation that entails boots on the ground in Afghanistan.
Right. I don't think that's done. In terms of boots on the ground, but I see something more like, if we go back to the '90s or in the Clinton administration, like we had aerial strikes in Iraq several times.
Drone the shit out of them.
Yeah.
So I can see us doing that.
We could see that happening. Another point, like we keep making the same mistakes with our foreign misadventures over and over again. A good example here. So because of the way we're leaving, there is all of this military equipment in addition to the bases, tanks, mortars, guns, all this stuff that is now in the hands of the Taliban. So we have created a Taliban now that is more equipped, has a greater arsenal than they did before, ironically, because we're leaving all of this behind and we're not taking it with us. This is a mistake that we've made over and over. We made this when we left Iraq back in 2014. We made this in Syria. You know, we had some troops in Syria and presence there. When we quickly left Syria during the Trump administration, we left behind weapons there that got into the hands of our enemies in ISIS. And I that frustrates me to no end that we make this mistake time and time again. We end up, when we leave somewhere, we don't take everything with us. So we end up arming our adversaries,
I think that stuff has more of a propaganda value than anything. I mean, the pictures of Taliban with American equipment, that's just, that just makes me enraged because you know tax money paid for every single piece of that equipment.
Right.
And when you make the argument that the military has just turned into a big giant jobs program, you can point to stuff like that. I think, again, what was the alternative? Were we just going to blow that stuff up? Because we don't have the time because we've pissed around for so long. We can't load all that stuff up.
And that's what I'm saying, though. It's why do we make these same mistakes like again and again? And I agree, we didn't have the time this time, but it just, you see it happen again and again. It's like we constantly undo and undermine our own initiatives. And we can go way back, and I know we haven't talked about this, but if we go back to the 1980s with the Russians in Afghanistan, we covertly armed the Mujahideen, who became the Taliban, right? So we indirectly helped in the rise of the Taliban, which hurt us later on because we were fighting the Soviets in this proxy war in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union.
Any arm you dump in there eventually gets pointed at you eventually.
So I don't know if you, and we're going off on a tangent a little bit, but I really wanted to talk about this because I went down the rabbit hole of our involvement in Afghanistan over the past, 30, 40 years. And I did not know about this. There was this little known program back in the late 80s to early 90s where we actually created textbooks for Afghan school kids, arithmetic, math textbooks that for like basically elementary school kids. We funneled them into Afghanistan. It was part of a U.S. AID project. Billions spent on this. I forget how much. But these textbooks basically provided lessons, school lessons, but using very violent imagery. So it was using like bombs going off and people being like slashed. And so the idea was we wanted to train Afghan school kids to hate the Soviets. And so we really propped up fundamentalist Islam and said like, look within yourself and what is,
that's
Islam
not come
tells
back
you
to bite
do.
Us in the ass at all.
No. And these textbooks even used the term like infidels, fight off the invading infidels. Now they had pictures of Soviets, but all of the,
I'm sure dude, Afghani, one white person is the same as another white person.
And when you're using interchangeable terms like infidels and you're using, so you, there was an Afghan peacekeeping organization that actually commented on this. And they said, you would never give these textbooks to your own kids in America because they're so violent and inappropriate. And you were basically radicalizing them all under the pretense of hoping to get them to hate the Soviets. And guess what? The Soviets were out of there in a few years. But guess what? These textbooks are still over there. They're still used. And they trained an entire generation to become radicalized. And then I found out that these textbooks were published in this clandestine operation out of all places, Omaha, Nebraska. The University of Nebraska, Omaha was where these textbooks were printed. There was this whole like top secret
the Huskers for multiple reasons. That's another one.
So anyway, I have like a side project to like find out more about this. this because it's super compelling. And my first thought was, like, this is ripe for, like, a Netflix documentary or some type of, like, because nobody knows about this.
We need to find who wrote those.
And I want to find a copy. They're still around, apparently, in Afghanistan. There's copies that are floated out there.
So let's pivot a little bit and talk about the military. Because I can't, this is the debate I've been having with myself since all of this happened. And I can't find a spot to land on. If we're going to spend a gajillion dollars a year on our military, shouldn't long-term engagements, if for no other reason, to promote peace and human rights in a region, is that worth it? Is that a good use of the military? Should that be part of the mission we put on the military? I don't know. But if what I keep coming back to is if we're Sparta and we're keep going to spending like we're Sparta and we're going to keep spending to fight a style of war that doesn't exist anymore. Okay. We have to justify that. And if parking 25,000 troops in Afghanistan at an airbase that has strategic value to us for now until the end of time, is that okay? Is that an expectation of the United States military?
So, I mean, I think the humanitarian component is different than the peacekeeping component. I think there is value. And I want to say that particularly for any of our soldiers who may be feeling or having all kinds of feelings right now, who have served over there and wondering, like, did we do anything? Like, many of them accomplished a lot of good. They were able to improve outcomes for many Afghan civilians. The problem is that every engagement is different. And you have to look at that country, at the context of their history, and the type of society that you're working within, the confines of. Because while we were able to do a lot of good, none of that was going to be sustained. And that was proven that that couldn't be sustained. It was all fleeting. So if we do a lot of good, but there's no long-lasting way to sustain that within the society, then we really need to question whether or not we should be in there in the first place doing that. If we are in a society where they have had exposure to that, and it's more of just trying to rebuild after a war and go back to where they were before, that's very different. And I think those are cases where our humanitarian work will pay off and produce return on our investment. And we've had those places where that has been the case. So it really has to be a case-by-case engagement analysis, yeah. I think.
A lot of the 90s Republican neocons, these are your Frums, your Frenches, yeah. Your Crystals, they've spent a lot of time this week talking about victory and the need for the American military to be victorious. Does that concept still apply?
How do we define victory
in Afghanistan?
I think that's a great example. Can you name the last war that we actually had like a solid victory
in? Grenada?
Yeah. Or I guess, you know, the first Desert Storm.
There's
a point here, because with Desert Storm, we define victory as repelling Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. And we were successful in that, right? We did not take out Saddam Hussein, but that wasn't how we defined that war. So in terms of how we narrowly define that war, we were victorious. But I think in terms of like a larger scale war, you'd have to go back to World War
That's II. What I'm saying.
Korea was not a successful outcome.
No.
Vietnam was not a successful outcome.
No.
We haven't really had, and if you look at not just the wars that we've directly fought, but other regional conflicts around the globe, there haven't really been any victorious. There's been these just continuing conflicts that continue to fester and really have no outcome.
And is that, it used to mean something. I'm in my 50s. It used to mean something that the American military was the best in the world and we don't take L's. And when we show up, it's a good thing. And we fight with honor for honorable causes, leaving in honorable ways. Is that just old fashioned, old man, good old day thinking? Does anybody outside of that 90s neocon Republican club, do America still look at the military that way?
I don't think so. I think there's a lot you know, I think that naivete is gone. I think it's been replaced by a lot of cynicism. And I'm trying to think back. So during the conflict in the Balkans and Yugoslavia and Kosovo, like our troop involvement there, I mean, that was something that did proceed and have eventually a peaceful outcome. But that was also a very different type of conflict, right? That was a case where you had a leader who took control and began an ethnic cleansing campaign, and then that was repelled. But you were also working within the confines of countries that had previously operated democratically, and so it was about just reverting back to what was normal for them. Afghanistan has never had that sense of normal.
And without being too crass, it is getting weird. As Americans, we are getting beaten over the head with the Afghani women are going to go through potentially a terrible situation. There's no way around it. It's to say that the Taliban are not going to be terrible to women.
Right. They haven't disavowed their prior principles and
beliefs.
While
I'm horrified by that, does that mean we spend blood and treasure to prevent? Where does this line of thinking stop? When do we put boots on the ground in China because they have a million Muslims? They're basically put it in a term again. What does it mean to us anymore? Is that part of our thinking? Something immoral is happening in another part of the world. What doctrine are we under
right now? So we've always had, within the last like 30 or 40 years, we've had a tendency to, I think, correlate or apply that moral mission in cases where we could try to find a national security implication. And so outside of a direct national security implication, there may be a moral imperative, but we don't jump in, right? I mean, we only, and again, that's, I think, also, you know, I think points to some of the hypocrisy on our side, but, you know, it is what it is, right? We will highlight and point to the moral imperative when it suits us for some kind of related, either national security imperative or geopolitical, monetary.
I hate to say this, and this kind of brings us all tooted with a thud, but Osama bin Laden got everything he wanted out of the 9/11 attack. It couldn't be more successful. They laid a blueprint down. They got everything they wanted out of that attack with our disgraceful, embarrassing retreat from Afghanistan. I firmly believe we should leave Afghanistan, but we got to do better than what we showed the world the past week.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we need to be more thoughtful, cautious, and deliberative about any other foreign entanglements and engagements that we take on. But we also, I think this shows us, we need to have clearer stated objectives when we go in. And if those objectives change, those have to be clearly stated. We can't have this scenario, which we have, that has tended to be the most recent past, where our objectives are just kind of fluid and they're constantly changing and they're not communicated. And, you know, I think that that's part of it. And we need to really, I think, know history and what history says, and realize that, you know, what most of the rest of the world considers recent history, we tend to forget. So our impact has ramifications. What we did in the 80s had direct ramifications on Afghanistan being a terror base for Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda. And so, again, anytime there's going to be those aftershocks, we need to think about how that's going to impact that country. Not necessarily boots on the ground, but if it's covert action that's being taken, if it's, if it's dropping off extremist textbooks for grade school children, like all of this has to be looked at in the context of, the generational impact it's going to have.
I think I've firmly believed my entire life that the American presence around the globe is a positive thing, and that the globe is at its best when America is at its best in asserting American power and values across the globe.
Yeah.
I don't know if you could just by default say that anymore.
I don't think you can.
It's situation by situation.
It is situation. And I think you could have said that after the Second World War, the creation of NATO, what we were able to accomplish in post-war Germany and Japan. Like, there's a lot to celebrate. And if I'm feeling really nostalgic, I'll go back and read about how we created the post-war civil society in Japan, which has been remarkable, but that's no longer the case, throughout the world. And I think that we fail to see that countries with very different histories, very different backgrounds, very different contexts. We can't go in and just cookie cutter, you know, create democracy when they don't have those foundations. You have to have that foundation, and that's not something you can just build overnight and expect people to adapt to it.
I've got a couple of good friends that were career military people. One retired as a full board colonel. It was his career, deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq, multiple times. And the people that I know who made a career in the military are some of the brightest, sharpest, best people that I've ever met. And all of them will tell you they expect to get shit on in some way. It just becomes part of the job. You're going to get put in spots where you can accomplish great things, but you're also going to be put on things where you got to grab the shitty end of the stick, and that's the only way it's going to be. I don't think there was any way with the amount of incompetency that we've showed in Afghanistan over this 20 years from multiple presidents basically standing up and saying, I want to run away from that war as fast as I can. The fact that the soldiers on the ground held it together for so long and achieved as much positive stuff as we talked about that they did, it's really a testament to their work ethic and what they are as American soldiers.
Oh, yeah. And I think in spite of all of the obstacles working against them, our American soldiers on a one-on-one level with Afghani population were able to have a huge impact. Despite the fact that we had a lot of corruption flowing with the billions that were spent, relationships with contractors in Afghanistan, although you could make that case for Iraq, kind of slip of the tongue. But, and I gave this example, I think, when we were offline about this multi-billion-dollar road reconstruction project in Afghanistan. It was supposed to fund over 10,000 miles of roads. It came in at double the budget, and they had only funded 120 miles of roads, and those roads today have potholes and haven't even been touched again.
How long do you think it's going to take China to pick that back up and build those 10,000 miles?
Not long at all, because that's what China does. They go into these places. It was the same. We had schools and hospitals that were built and helped Afghans, but then we had many schools and hospitals that were built in remote areas that are empty buildings today that aren't helping anybody. And then a lot of those billions that we have spent in Afghanistan have been funneled to a very wealthy, corrupt elite, political elite in Afghanistan. It hasn't made its way down to the local population. There was a story out actually last year, which I thought was interesting, on the outskirts of a city just outside Kabul. There are these very ramshackle kind of shanty town homes that are built in the mountainside that are very unstable. And the city has been trying to do something to get them up to code and finally gave up. And the mayor of the city started a project where they were going to paint the shantytown homes in brightly colored colors to make the people feel better about their situation. Yeah. And so I thought that was weird, but remarkable, because I think it has symbolic and metaphoric value to say that there's a lot of what we did that surface layer is great, but, you know, trying to kind of say, hey, you know, look at this. But then beneath the surface, if you start getting down into the detail, a lot of this wasn't built to last. Those shanty towns that were painted look beautiful from the outside, but they're structurally unstable and will likely collapse if there's just, you know, a slight storm. And I think that could be said for our entire mission there, and as we
the military proved. Leadership has to answer, was this incompetence, ignorance, what was this? I mean, you had to know what the reality was with the boots on the ground with the Afghan army. You knew that the Taliban forces were in position to execute this kind of blitzkrieg move. You knew people were going to storm that airport. So again,
and I assume we knew that we weren't going to be there forever. So what was the end game? Did we ever discuss alternatives for ensuring that there would be some type of viable military defense of the capital and other parts of the country in our when we left? It, I mean, it doesn't seem like there was. So I don't know. Again, like you said, there's so many layers to this, and it's so incredibly multifaceted and complicated. But at the same time, I think what's frustrating is we've thrown billions and billions of dollars into it. And one of the central problems we always go back to is the inability to follow the money. There was an Inspector General report that came out toward the end of the Obama administration where they tracked just I think they focused on just $8 billion in project funding, and they found out that only $1 billion was accounted for. The other $6 to $7 billion were just completely unaccounted for.
Anytime we nation build, it just becomes a hole we throw money down.
Right.
That somebody's getting it on the back end that knows somebody on the front end that's feeding the hole. It builds into this whole cynicism about the military, political, industrial machine that we've been hearing about since Vietnam. But it's hard to say that that doesn't exist, or that we don't use our military as a way to, as an extension perhaps of certain segments of our economy.
Right.
Well, of course we do. We've done it for decades.
And President Eisenhower, his wise words, was warning about the military industrial complex. Yeah.
What is the political situation going to have to be to deploy the American military again in mass? For the American people to get behind a mass deployment, 50, 75,000 fighting combat troops, it's going to have to be a very, very...
It has to be something that would directly strike at the heart of our interest overseas or here. I mean, it would have to be very deliberate.
It'd have to be an attack on our soil again, I think.
Something like 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. I mean, if it's a major attack on one of our installations overseas, that might be enough. But it can't be something to where an ally is attacked and we're going to get in.
I don't think we care.
We've talked about the recent specter of China doing something in Taiwan. I don't think there's any appetite for us coming to the military defense of Taiwan in that case.
That would be, you would see mass protest, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah, completely. There's no appetite for that.
No. And is Biden going to have a cooling off period, let's say? I mean, we've got to get through this August 31st deadline. We've got to get some idea of where we are for evacuating people at the end of the month. How big of a job do we have ahead of us? And I really haven't heard Biden come out strongly and say, we're committing to that job.
No. And I think that's what I think is worrisome and why many people are having doubts, is because, you know, there isn't that strength of purpose and leadership. It's everything has been reluctant. I mean, he had this press conference reluctantly to have plans to actually address, the American people on this. So we don't have that yet. And so we're just waiting.
What I've been thinking about and being cynical about is we don't know how many U.S. citizens are in Afghanistan. And maybe the reason we don't know that is because these aren't native born Americans.
Right.
These
are mostly Afghani citizens. Could be as high as 15,000. And some of those have been, have left now in the last several days with the flights out, but I don't know how many.
I don't want to be totally cynical, but if those 15,000 people were all born in Omaha, Nebraska, they wouldn't be sitting there.
Yeah.
And I think that to me is what I'm waiting for. What is our level of commitment to get these people out of Afghanistan? And if we don't do everything we can, Biden is absolutely going to get massacred, and he deserves to.
Right. Well, and like you said, there's the perception that our allies, these other countries like Australia and Britain, are going the extra mile to get their people out more so than we are. And that doesn't look good either.
I don't care how tough we look. I don't care about taking the L. I want every person who wants to come out of there needs to come out.
Agreed.
And if you're an American citizen in whatever
that way, should be the number one priority now.
That's
if we fail on that, I mean, we don't deserve to be involved militarily anywhere else.
Do you have any confidence that we can do that?
Not based on the administration's statements so far. I mean, they provided no detail. And when they're asked specifically about checkpoints and people wanting to come out, Biden made some kind of flippant comment about, well, if it's somebody who's an American or an ally who has a visa, they just need to contact our people to get it. How do they contact
them? Where's the urgency here? That's what I don't get either. So I think over the next couple of weeks, this situation will play itself out.
We'll see how it goes.
I think we'll be able to accommodate the evacuation. But after that, I think Biden is going to try to turn everybody's attention to something else. I mean, and collectively we will, because America's already forgotten about this war.
We have short attention spans. We forget easily.
If this situation hadn't happened in the end, everybody would just be universally praising that we got out of Afghanistan.
Nobody was paying attention last year when this agreement was signed.
No,
I mean,
nobody cared. there were way more entertaining things to worry about with Trump than whatever he did here. You want to talk about, I don't want to talk about COVID. You want to talk about COVID?
Gosh, I really don't. I mean, there isn't really any update other than the fights we're seeing on between governors and school districts.
Abbott got COVID.
Yeah. Which is, it's interesting though. He got Regeneron treatment like right away. So, you know,
I mean, being in a wheelchair, I'm assuming he's got some pre-existing conditions that could really, really complicate that.
Yeah.
The only thing I'm interested in is DeSantis, because he is a viable candidate for 2024 on the Republican side, and just trying to see how long he sticks with playing this political hand he's playing.
Right. Even as his poll numbers drop and, you know, he is starting to fail on head-to-head matchups with his likely opponents, he is still holding on.
And this is, I mean, DeSantis is a smart guy, and he has learned the number one lesson with MAGA. If you're going after that crowd, you never ask anything of them. You never ask them to do anything. You never tell them they're wrong about something. You never challenge them in any way. And DeSantis is, he's going to play, that's the hand he's playing. I'm just interested to see how long he plays it.
I mean, if he were to lose re-election, do you think that that would change the calculus for presidency or not?
I don't think so.
That's what
Florida,
I tend to hear people seem to.
Goofy state too.
It is.
For president, for politics. I don't think it does. Who, because other than DeSantis, the Republicans have the same problem as the Democrats. After DeSantis and Biden, I shudder to think who's running if it's not those two in 2024.
There is no other candidate in the wings. And that's why I think the you know, MAGA crowd is so defensive of DeSantis and willing to, you know, do anything for him, because they realize there isn't anybody outside of him. Like, he's their guy.
And I'm almost willing to bet some significant money that it's not Biden going to run against.
Yeah.
He was a Republican in 2024.
I'm starting to agree with you on that.
I texted this to somebody. I'm on record. I've never voted Republican in my life. I cannot vote for Joe Biden in 2024 if he runs for president. I cannot vote for an 82-year-old, just on principle of that is way too old for anyone to carry that much responsibility and to ask them to mentally and physically do that job. There's just no way. Biden is not senile. Biden is not crazy. Biden hasn't lost his mind. He's just old.
He's just old.
And he's not equipped to handle some of the press demands and some of the interview demands.
No, because you can't react as quickly mentally.
He's not as sharp. He likes a teleprompter. It is what it is. It doesn't make him incapable of being president of the United States. He's just old.
Right.
But there's 82. There's no way.
Yeah.
Trump would be 78.
I know. That's
insane.
Isn't it crazy? That's, you know, where we go for our leaders. You know, we're just
Outer Banks. Yeah, I watched all season two. And now I'm like, I can't find anything trashy to watch. My wife and I, we sat down last night. We watched like the latest episode of Ted Lasso.
I haven't started Outer Banks yet. Yep, I've been watching Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso's picked up a little bit too. The last couple episodes have been pretty good.
The season started a little bit slow, but the last few episodes have been good.
What do you think about the guy at Jeopardy getting booted off already? The executive producer who took that role. What a dick move that is.
No kidding. I was surprised by how quickly that happened too. And this was over, was this tweets that resurfaced?
Podcast. He was on some podcast and like That's 8 years ago. I think he made some sexist and misogynist marks or something.
Yeah.
I think again, nobody was happy with that choice. Everybody thought, wait a minute, why is the producer just naming himself for the show? There's been a groundswell for some other folks. And I think the internet just came for him.
So in a moment of like, I think, very much appreciated the self-deprecation. Did you see Anthony Scaramucci retweeted that and said, I'm happy to take the gig for, you know, a whole 9 days if somebody wants me?
He'd probably be pretty good at
it. He probably would.
God, I didn't realize how deeply, passionately people feel Jeopardy.
Yeah.
He has a huge, passionate fan base. I know LeVar Burton from Star Trek and Reading Rainbow. There's a big push to try to get him.
He would be
this.
A great choice for
Ken
that.
Ken Jennings is another one that people like, but he's had some stupid... Ken Jennings says a lot of weird stuff.
He does, and he seems some pretty odd dry stuff. And I don't know if he's got any mass appeal,
but hopefully the world will get better and Jeopardy will work itself out next week.
Yeah.
That's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening to 2 Men in the Middle. Make sure to give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Check out our website at 2meninthemiddle.com. Drop us an email at 2meninthemiddle@gmail.com or tweet at us at 2meninthemiddle. We'll see you next week.